With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Cassell, and with me today is special guest Kevin Wall.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Always happy to bring on cross-country and Olympic sport aficionado Kevin. Dan had some car issues he had to tend to, so we turn to the next man up, so to speak. And Kevin, how are things in Onondaga County?
Hot. We're in the midst of a heat wave here in Syracuse. So supposed to break in a couple of days, but 90 degrees. So just for all those people that say Syracuse is a terrible place, you wouldn't want to be there. This is proving them wrong.
Definitively. I know we're dealing with the back end of quote unquote June gloom here in LA, where it is a freezing quote unquote 70 degrees.
I think we'd trade some of that with you right now. So,
well, at least out here we get the benefit, like, you know, being closer to the water. At least we get the benefit of it never really getting above like 85 or so.
Yeah, we're in the midst of not only heat but humidity too. So that's it's like August here right now. So be welcoming, I'm sure, for all the football players that are back on campus.
Yeah. So I guess we'll talk about football. I know you kind of alluded to that there. I'm writing an article as we speak about this. The Patriot League brass mentioned on Monday that they want players for sports that end by the end of November to arrive at the same time as other students. That means that potentially, you know, you'd have football teams and players arriving on campus in late August for a season that starts in late August. According to the NCAA Division I Council, that's not allowed. You need 6 weeks of prep for seasons that start in the fall. So that would mean you're showing up in July for an August start. Not ideal for Syracuse's week three opponent, Colgate, who was supposed to be the home opener for the refurbished dome. Obviously, Colgate and other schools have kind of not necessarily bought into this just yet. According to statements they've made to press, it seems that they would rather not comment just yet. And I think that they don't want to necessarily sell out their entire non-conference schedule. If you're Colgate or any school in the Patriot League, those dollars are pretty important. Those dates against, you know, both nearby foes like Syracuse is for Colgate, as well as Western Michigan, who Colgate also travels to, the non-conference schedule. Definitely critical games for them and their athletic department getting those paydays. Kevin, you being a little bit closer to the area and obviously knowing, you know, what you know about, you know, the non-conference schedules and Colgate in particular, like, how do you feel this is going to go? Do you think that this ends up getting walked back? Do you think the Colgate ends up going, Colgate and other Patriot League teams end up going online only? This obviously could throw a real wrench in the plans for Syracuse already, even months before the season starts.
Sure. One of the things that Colgate has not come out and stated whether or not they would have on-campus classes this fall. So unlike Syracuse and a lot of other schools, which are making arrangements to bring back students a week early, in SU's case, with classes ending on campus by Thanksgiving and then students not coming back until January, Colgate hasn't announced their plan. So I think there's one aspect of from the academic side with the Patriot League schools what they've said academically. Then we have these other issues with athletics. Now, the first ruling said that they wouldn't have overnight travel, which would seemingly allow Colgate to bus to play Syracuse and bus back after the game. But as you mentioned, it's that 6-week period of practice, which if they're not reporting before the semester begins, they wouldn't meet that. There has to be an answer soon, because right now Syracuse would need an opponent for the Dome. And if they walked it back and switched and moved the bye week, you'd be talking about Syracuse opening with 2 road games, a bye week, and then going back on the road again, which the 2 road games to start the year is less than ideal. But we know that that's partly because of the Dome renovations and allowing some extra time there. But opening a season, especially after last year's disappointment with 3 straight road games, is probably something that Dino Babers wants to avoid. And, you know, if Syracuse starts looking for a replacement opponent, that's going to be a huge impact for Colgate's revenue stream. And so I'm sure that they don't want that to happen. So I would imagine we would probably get a little bit more clarity in the next couple of days, because I think someone's going to have to make that decision. Looking at who Patriot League teams had in that week, the other options which might become available for Syracuse would then be Columbia, Harvard, or William and Mary. And so I don't know if any of those scenarios are places that Syracuse would look. I think Columbia might be a first option, because then you'd be talking about another bus trip, but less than ideal, obviously, to be almost in July and be worrying about your week 3 opponent.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, this one at least is through no fault of Syracuse's. And it's usually the case where, you know, SU messes up scheduling royally and ends up having to deal with last minute additions. In this case, you know, Syracuse can't really do anything about the Patriot League or coronavirus concerns. I know like Columbia and Yale would be a little bit tougher, just because I know the Ivy League usually tries to avoid D1, FBS games. They make exceptions here and there, but by and large, you know, the Ivy team do try to avoid, you know, getting batted around by FBS teams, and especially Power 5 teams. I would say William & Mary is probably the most likely opponent, though I'm sure they also don't necessarily want to head up to the Dome just to get knocked around. And I'm sure they already have, I mean, not looking at their schedule right now, I'm sure William & Mary already has, you know, like VTech or Virginia on the slate for 2020. And they're at least a much closer, actually, no, they're headed to Stanford.
Ooh.
Which I'm sure they'd love to postpone that one and head to the Dome instead.
Yeah, you know, then it comes into what Syracuse is going to have to pay to get someone. So would they, whatever their fee they're paying Colgate, I would imagine is less than what they would bring another school who's flying and spending a night in Syracuse. So from a cost standpoint, especially at this time where we don't know if there's going to be fans in the stands and athletic departments are concerned about revenues and budgets, certainly not something that Syracuse wants to do is open the checkbook to fill a game. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, maybe this is one of those situations where they look to postpone it or change the date. Would the ACC allow them to push it back to the end of the regular season? And, you know, Syracuse could make the decision of whether they need to play the game or not. You know, there's a lot of interesting scenarios that could play out around this, depending on how flexible people want to be within both leagues.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, like, this requires, you know, some ACC and some FBS permissions too. I mean, there's a possibility maybe that if they held it off, I mean, and you look at the schedule now, this actually says that Syracuse would not be able to face Colgate, you know, if they tacked on a game for the first week of December potentially. And based on, you know, the fact that SU is trying to get everybody off campus by the end of November, I would think it's unlikely that they would add a game at the end. So you'd be looking at maybe an 11 game season for Syracuse, eliminating their easiest opponent in Colgate. I would assume they wouldn't be the only team that'd be in this type of scenario based on the way things are trending. So perhaps, you know, SU, if they end up 5-6, could get a waiver and be a bowl eligible. However, you know, you and I have talked about this in different articles and on podcasts in the past. I would think that if coronavirus concerns and campus safety concerns and travel concerns for conferences are this serious, especially right now, never mind, you know, later on in the year we get into flu season and all. I don't think bowl eligibility will matter much, save for the top teams anyway.
Yeah, I would agree with that. There's so much uncertainty right now that, you know, all we can do is speculate. I think at this point, you know, I wouldn't rule anything out. I think flexibility is going to have to be the key in the name of the game when it comes to NCAA and conference rules and even what some of the schools want to do. So if Colgate can't play the game week three, you could see it left as a, you know, if needed basis. You know, if the situation arose where Syracuse was sitting at 5-6 and they needed that extra win for bowl eligibility, the schools may agree to play it, depending on where we are in November. Or like you said, there could be a waiver scenario. I think, you know, there's going to have to be some clarity from these leagues. It seems like the Patriot League, even though it seems a little harsh, was trying to provide that for their member schools. And so we'll kind of wait and see. And it's interesting because news came out of the ACC that there's going to be a new sort of governing structure with Kent Siverud who's going to be in charge. And it seems like college presidents are going to have a little bit more say in the conference. So, which could be interesting how that plays out.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like you said, there's just so much more left to go here. And really, based on how things are evolving, based on how, you know, a lot of, you know, reopen kind of phased approaches have not seemed to work necessarily as planned around the country. And given how many like players are testing positive when they return, I mean, I don't think anyone kid themselves into thinking that no one would test positive upon returning, especially at schools like, you know, like an SU or other private schools. Also like just larger, you know, football factories that recruit talent from around the country. Like, I don't think anyone thought that they were going to be able to bring everyone back in June and suddenly have like absolutely no issues and be able to return to camp and all that. But at the same time, I think seeing like Clemson, who had like 23 cases, you know, positive cases or at least people, you know, in quarantine right now, and other schools presenting, you know, 8 to 10 cases at minimum. Like, I don't think schools and coaches and programs are necessarily prepared for that. Or at least like the you know, PR that comes with that. And I think it's definitely causing a little bit of panic, even if things will subside once everyone hopefully, you know, quarantines, recovers, and then we don't see any other issues this summer.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that probably the expectation was in these smaller pods, you might see one or two, you know, athletes on a team or maybe a support staff, a manager or something, where they could be isolated and quarantined and you could prevent an outbreak on campus. But the numbers that you saw at Clemson and LSU and Kansas State throw that a little bit into a bigger concern. You know, I assumed that if nothing else, we would have college football played in front of either empty stadiums or students and bands because of the TV money, and that no school could forego canceling the season at this point. But you have to question then now what happens with the ongoing testing and how teams are going to handle this when they welcome a student body back to campus. You know, are they going to put a bubble around these football teams and where they don't leave athletic facilities and they only take online classes and they're asked not to do any sort of socializing with the larger student body? You know, sort of like the NBA was proposing with their Disney bubble. I think programs are going to try to do that as best possible, but as we saw in both Clemson and LSU, it seemed like those outbreaks were simply college students being college students.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, college students being college students is a challenge. There's just the fact, I mean, I even see around here, like neighborhood wise, like, and there's plenty of people that aren't wearing masks in certain situations, but by and large, the people that aren't in public and in certain spaces and are hanging out with friends or people, you know, under age 18, obviously these players are in 18 to 22 range, but like stuff happens and people aren't necessarily like even the most responsible person. It just takes one potential slip up, you know, for a possible infection. I think that's really the issue here, is that like, no matter how careful you are, it really just does just take one, you know, random and not even intentional error. So yeah, I'm starting to see some doubts, at least for me, creep in a little bit about you know, returning to college football, and I'm especially at a place like Syracuse where, you know, the team plays indoors. I'm finding it hard to believe that they're going to be able to, you know, host several opponents, be able to guarantee everybody's safety, be able to have any fans in the stands at all. Definitely seems less than ideal. Obviously, we don't have to like dive too. I don't think we have to dive any further in necessarily, but I think what we thought we knew maybe a week or two ago has definitely been cast into some doubt now.
Right. Yep. And I still wouldn't be surprised if schools are thinking about some sort of delay or looking at overlapping into the spring semester, like we talked about back in March, and people kind of poo-pooed that idea. But I wouldn't be surprised if any option, in all options, are on the table now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think at this point, like we've reached not a point of no return, but we've definitely reached a point where things need to be corrected. Things need to be like, we need to start seeing plans in place. I think from football, I think, you know, basketball seemed to move fairly quickly. I think hockey moved quickly to some extent. I think you saw, you know, less like contact driven sports like golf and NASCAR, you know, put plans in play and start getting athletes back on the field of play. But I find that football has largely, pro and college, is really kind of like wipe their hands of the issue to some extent and say, hey, we'll figure it out. Well, like, you know, we're one tragedy away from the entire season just being canceled. So realistically, you would think that maybe all these positive tests at least spur some sort of action in a hurry to get a real and tangible rollout plan in place that ensures there's some sort of season.
Definitely agree with you there.
So I guess changing pace a little bit, something that is like, you know, COVID like adjacent. ACC Network, just like every other sports focused network on television, has had to pivot what they're doing on TV without live games, without a whole lot to talk about in terms of like recent results. I think that like while ESPN received praise for, you know, how it, I think, picked up, you know, Korean baseball and how it had The Last Dance and how it's had some other 30 for 30s that rolled out. I know esports has appeared a ton on ESPN networks and Fox Sports 1. Realistically, I think a lot of sports networks have really kind of showed just how shackled they are to a very kind of static way of thinking. I think that, you know, ESPN has been creative. They've done some things that they have a lot more to talk about around off the field issues and I guess just off the field concerns. But like, realistically, there's only so much of that viewers will participate in. And at some point, you know, you need to kind of give people another reason to tune in. You know, I really rarely watched ESPN, save those like very like special kind of one-off TV moments like The Last Dance. And the ACC network, I think, just like SEC network, the Big Ten network too, like have really kind of, let's say the Big Ten at least has some specials and things like that focused on certain teams. But I think the ACC and SEC network have really kind of failed in this regard, where they've given fans no real reason to tune in past the first month or so. Once you get through the big games and you just end up with this this very kind of boring and stale slate of the same games, or like a theme week where it's like sort of a theme, but it's the same game twice in a day. There's only so much programming. There's only so much you can say about these games that happened already. Like, I mean, I know you've been a long time proponent of this. Like, there was so much that even with people remote that you'd be able to put on TV around Syracuse and around all the other 14 schools in the ACC that would have made the ACC network a far more compelling watch.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Right. And so this past weekend, they did a Vince Carter Day. And that's great. And my question would be, why not in March did you send something out to every school and said, pick a male and a female athlete that you would highlight and promote, you know, pick X number of games, bring that person, people that know them, involved with interviews, filler that we can do, and do some sort of promotion. And yeah, maybe there isn't a huge market for it, but like you said, you're trying to expand that reach. So let's say Syracuse did something different. Now Dwight Freeney's on the College Football Hall of Fame ballot. We knew that was going to happen if we had a Dwight Freeney special. And you can get Dwight Freeney, and you could get Chandler Jones, and you could get Kendall Coleman or Alton Robinson, people who played the position, talking about Dwight Freeney at Syracuse, talking about his pro career, and doing something like that. I, you know, as the Olympic sports guy, we're heading up on the fifth anniversary this November of the cross country, men's cross country and women's field hockey winning national titles in the same weekend. So wear something about that. You know, the network, they have access to these contests, and you don't need to show maybe the entire field hockey game. That's fine if you don't want to do that, but boil it down into a 30-minute to an hour special where you intersperse some interviews, or you do something remote where you get athletes from these teams to talk about what was going on, what was going through their minds. You know, we had Justin Knight on, a pod sportscaster. He's been on a million podcasts. He loves talking about Syracuse. He'd be more than happy to go on with Matt Parker, Brian Higgins, and recap that national championship that the team won, or his individual national championship, or one of his double-digit ACC championships. I mean, there's a guy, I just filled you a day of Justin Knight content, and, you know, in 2 minutes. And so I think there's a lot that could have been done. It's disappointing that, you know, we knew as soon as the ACC tournament ended that there was going to be this gap. There wasn't going to be baseball. There wasn't going to be lacrosse. And it just feels like a great opportunity has been wasted by the conference, the network, and the schools themselves to really do some great promotional events.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, ultimately, you know, any conference network is basically a commercial for the schools and the teams that play as representatives of those schools. And it just seems like, you know, having this sort of, I mean, like, what, today or tomorrow, like, one of the games, like, you see it twice in a day, is like Clemson versus Western Carolina, like softball. I mean, there should definitely be softball focused, and there should definitely be days dedicated to certain non-revenue sports, things like that. Like, are you really going to tell me that like showing, you know, 2 to 2.5 hours of Clemson versus Western Carolina softball is really valuable to Clemson, to the ACC, to anyone involved when there's like so many, you know, intra-conference matchups and so many players and coaches and personalities and traditions and other things that you can focus on just in softball alone, never mind the other sports that the league sponsors. Just seems, and again, it's not even just like the recent stuff. I mean, the ACC has been broadcasting games on ESPN for decades, you know, dating back to the Big East days for a lot of these teams. Like, there's like 4 decades worth of inventory here that you're able to mine. And just it's mind blowing, even like on a Syracuse level, seeing us repeatedly get shown, you know, the same 1-0 Syracuse Colgate women's soccer win or just being shown the Hobart game for Syracuse men's lacrosse. Or really like getting close to nothing on the women's lacrosse team, despite the fact that, you know, they've had some great games over the years. And even in the last 6 months, like I'm beyond puzzled as to how we ended up here and how the league really expects to make money off of this network. When a golden opportunity like this has been kind of like, you know, swung at and missed so hard.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know that they've brought the Packer and Durham show back now, but they were off for a couple months. I mean, there are some very talented people involved with the network that were probably home with a lot of time and a lot of availability. And it's just disappointing that, again, like you said, you keep recycling the same things when you've got so much content available, so many stories that you could tell. And a great opportunity for the conference and the schools to really push themselves into a bigger spotlight than would normally exist.
Agreed. ACC, if you're listening, and I'll be writing something about this myself just because I'm like getting pretty annoyed about it. Hopefully,
we're available to consult.
And we are available to consult for money or swag.
Right.
Kevin, I know you're not usually as much of a drinker as Dan and I, but it is halftime, so wanted to see, what have you been drinking?
Actually, it's been Sam Adams Summer Ale season for me, so that's my kind of go-to, because we haven't been going out anywhere. Picked that up and working slowly through that right now, but excited to get out now that places are opening up around here and to start connecting with some friends and sampling some more local brews.
Nice. Yeah, we're starting to see a little bit of opening. I know one of the brewers around here, Smug City, that I talk about a lot, actually expanded their seating into the parking lot, which I thought was pretty smart. And they have picnic tables and umbrellas and a lot more just like set up to at least make it more safe and accommodating for folks. So might end up over there at some point. We'll see. For right now, I have still yet to be anywhere really since like early March. But better safe than sorry, at least for me right now. A couple of my beer picks for the week had from Highland Park, Hazy Double IPA, World Champ. Really good hazy. I'm not a big hazy fan, but I think Highland Park does it better than most around here. Had Mosaic, Citra, and Vic Secret hops featured. I felt like it was just interesting, good drink. Finished my last can of Good Green from Highland Park, just a West Coast IPA. So grabbed a West Coast IPA from Chapman Crafted down in Orange County. Welcome to Citra. Had a couple of those. Had a Chapman Crafted Pills. And also had from Celador Ales up in the North Hollywood. I forgot exactly where they are. I think North Hills area. Grabbed a Gozesque Nectarine. It's just a really good sour. And that was how I capped my Father's Day. I know most fathers this year, I felt, you know, didn't really have much to do, but my main request was just being able to drink a beer in peace. So mission accomplished.
Nice. Always have to celebrate those wins.
Yeah. When you have somebody under the age of two in the house, it's not the easiest victory to pick up, but figured it out.
No, it's not the easiest, and that's why you celebrate them.
So, Kevin, as you were informed before the show started, along with Syracuse news during the off season, we usually around June start picking up the non-conference, but Group of Five and then Power Five previews going down the line. And just, you know, I mean, Dan and I are big fans of the whole picture of college football. I know you enjoy, you know, a good stacked college football Saturday as well. So today we're talking Mountain West. That's everybody's final warning. Guess we can start with Boise State. We're not going to run through everybody necessarily, but did want to at least give people a clearer picture of what, you know, each league in the country looks like. So the Mountain West, we start with Boise State. I actually think this Boise State team is not necessarily what it's been in the past. I think Boise in general lately is just, it's not that they've been bad by any means. I just think you're seeing like a slight return to the rest of the group. And I think part of that, unfortunately, is a result of the rest of the Mountain West kind of not sucking wind, but just failing to live up to potential. And that kind of ends up discrediting what Boise's doing, even if it is impressive that they've competed at the top of this league for so long.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the interesting piece you mentioned. The last part is their consistency. And so when you talk about being able to turn over coaches and still maintain a level of success, and even if it's a step below the P5, you know, Boise's just been a solid program for a long time now. And it is unfortunate that the rest of the league has sort of tailed off, and that certainly hampers their sort of national standing. But they're one of those schools that I think for people who aren't college football playoff, you know, bound, you know, the goals aren't going to be the playoff. you know, their program that you look at, and I look at Syracuse, would be like, hey, that's a program where if you can model that sort of consistent success and 7 or 8 wins, that's a good program. And doing it with coaches that are, you know, transitioning and turning over as frequently, it's a nice sort of template that when Syracuse gets around to looking for a next coach, you know, you hope they've built up a program where you can slide the next person in and they can keep that going.
Yeah, I mean, Boise's kind of figured it out. Like, and I was up in Boise last summer for a few days and got to walk around campus a bit, and really, like, was, and I know I told you guys, you know, in the fabled noon Slack, but really just impressive facilities, just really impressive, like, fan support. The city really gets behind them. And then obviously, like, they also understand the merch game better than most. And I, you know, credit them a ton for that. And I think that, you know, Boise has figured something out. And I don't necessarily know how replicable it is. I think that Syracuse could take some notes. I think a lot of other schools could take some notes too about how to at least create a culture that doesn't necessarily rely on a coach, singular coach, and more just, you know, an idea and a staff identity and things like that. So, I mean, I hope we don't lose Dino Babers anytime soon, but if for some reason it happens, good or bad, I hope that that the handoff is as clean as it's been at Boise. Really, I think Boise, you know, like most teams, I think they're going to go as fast as their quarterback can. Hank Bachmeier is definitely a player who is going to lead this Broncos team as far as they can go. I think his numbers last year don't necessarily show a guy who's, you know, going to be in that same conversation as a player like maybe a Kellen Moore or others who have suited up for the Broncos. But he also seems like someone with some potential. I think I'm not going to doubt a guy's freshman numbers too much, if only because Boise has such a, you know, strong track record of recruiting good quarterbacks.
Right. He won at Florida State last year, and they get Florida State at home this year. So that's an interesting game for Syracuse fans to see kind of what this year's Florida State team's going to look like too early on and relatively early in the season. So, anytime you have a freshman that can go in and win on the road in that sort of environment, and we know Florida State wasn't great last year, it's got to be a good sign for a school like Boise, you know, and you're going to be looking to compete in your, not only for your conference title, but for that New Year's 6 bowl slot, and to know you've got at least 2 more years, you know, with a poised quarterback, always a good sign in college.
Agreed. So I guess, Kevin, who do you think is Boise's biggest challenge in the Mountain? Utah State and Wyoming both had solid seasons last year. New Mexico, I think, is just kind of doomed to struggle for now. Colorado State could look good eventually. I think Steve Adazio wasn't the worst hire. It's also not really an inspired one. And I think this group should know how we usually feel about Adazio and what he did at Boston College. It's Wyoming and Utah State and maybe Air Force seem like the most likely teams to really start pressing Boise.
Yeah, I think Air Force is interesting. I'm a sucker for the option attack offense. Air Force was one of my favorite teams, NCAA football teams, to play with to run that offense. And they, Boise's schedule, Boise goes Georgia Southern, Air Force, Florida State. So at Air Force in week 2 is an interesting challenge. And you know, if Air Force can get that home win, that gives them a big jump up. Utah State's going to replace Jordan Love, and it's too bad that you don't have Dan here to talk about him as the Packers fan. But, so that's going to be a difficult, losing a first-round NFL talent at quarterback is going to be interesting to see how they can rebound. And Adazio, you know, probably in a couple years will have Colorado State to a solid. You know, he'll get offensive linemen, so you'll know they'll be able to run the ball. You know, his conservative style, they want to keep games, you know, close. And I think he can find some success. But I don't think immediately. I think that'll take a little time. And even though he's uninspired for a program, I think, you know, you could do worse than having a guy who's going to be able to make you competitive in games. Wyoming is going to be an interesting team, I think, for Boise. You know, that's what's kind of fun about the Mountain West to me, of the next the G6 group there. They play some interesting football, and on the East Coast you often get overlooked because of the time of games, but a lot of interesting style clashes that you see, and some definitely some games that are kind of fun to watch from just a fan perspective.
Yeah, I mean, in general, like I do enjoy, like, there's a lot of reasons I enjoy being out here. One of them is just the fact that, you know, I get to see these games at a reasonable hour, and I do get to watch a good amount of Mountain West and Pac-12. I mean, I also have family connections to the Mountain West, with most of my in-laws going to San Diego State. But in general, like, yeah, I think the stylistic clashes, the fact that you have, I think, so like the Mountain West in particular, like, it seems like they're not rising coaches that are going to be gone in a couple of years, the way you see it, you see USA and the MAC and American Athletic Conference. I think, you know, with the Mountain West, there was an interesting run of hires where it's guys like, you know, Calhoun or guys like Craig Bull at Wyoming, guys who showed up at new places and now, like, you know, four or five, six years in, are just like impressive coaches who've been able to redefine what program success looks like. And I think that's fun. It provides, you know, a lot of year to year intrigue. It also makes it hard though at this point to break through into kind of that upper crust. And I think Wyoming impressively has been able to become part of the top half, maybe even top third of the Mountain West, which is not an easy feat, especially when you have to share a division with Boise.
Yeah, agreed. I think there's something to be said for the conference hiring coaches with head coaching experience. And even if it was at the FCS level, you know, you see you guys who have had winning programs, and so they know what it takes to build and they know what they're looking for. And I think they, you know, talk about forming an identity. I think that's one of the things that they kind of have. And so when you get the MAC and the, you know, AAC, where they often hire the, you know, rising offensive coordinator, you know, of the day and bring that person in, and then they might be gone in 2 years and they've recruited athletes for a certain style. And if you don't replace that exact style, you see the program step back. You know, whereas the Mountain West is going for these older, more established coaches, you know, who believe in a system. And I think for college football teams, when you don't have talent, I think there, or don't have the level of talent that you see at the P5, if you have a system that you believe in and that you can execute, you can be competitive. And I think, to me as a fan, that's what makes, you know, some of these matchups fun to watch, and that contrast of styles. And, you know, if there's a school that could break through next, you would think it would be UNLV because of, you know, moving into the Raiders stadium and sharing that facility, the appeal of Vegas as a recruiting area. But boy, they just can't seem to get themselves to that next step.
Yeah, I mean, you know, now we're headed over to the West Division. I do think that, you know, UNLV, I think for years now, Dan and I have talked about this when we've done these sort of previews for years. UNLV seems like they're primed for a jump. They've long been in a situation where they could, you know, they even tapped into local kind of high school powerhouses to try and hire in a way that would give them more of that talent. I think it's just, Nevada's not a talent-rich state necessarily. And on top of that, the most talented kids almost always go to Pac-12 schools. So now you have a problem where this is like something that Rutgers deals with a little bit too. But maybe not to the same extent exactly. Is that, you know, Nevada is talent poor for the most part. I think there's really, I mean, screw the Rutgers comparison. This is actually more of a Syracuse comparison, honestly, than anything else. Is that, you know, New York is talent questionable, as I've said before. And Syracuse seems like they usually are missing out on the very, very top guys. I think, you know, I think for UNLV, obviously having a lesser brand than Syracuse, less success, fewer resources, having that problem, having even less talent in Nevada than there is in New York, and then having, you know, SC, UCLA, Oregon, Washington, even like Texas schools that are easily able to go in there. Like there are a lot of challenges for them to be able to compete. And I think that playing in the Raider Stadium gives them an opportunity, but I think it's still playing the long game. And I do think that the West Division is still, once again, kind of San Diego State's to lose.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, San Diego State, with the going back to Brady Hoke, will be interesting to watch. And, the Syracuse connection, where we thought Rocky Long was going to step down to come to Syracuse. And then the whole – remember when Zach Arnett was the Syracuse defensive coordinator? It was like that was like 5 years ago now at this point. But, San Diego State, I think of when Marshall Faulk was there, and I just think of that, that all-black uniform that they had and watching him run the ball. And obviously, they're able to have better access to the California talent. And when we talked about Syracuse and recruiting, and I think that's what some of these schools need to do in the Mountain West, is in-state, they're not going to get the top players, but identifying that system and going to surrounding areas where there's an appeal to pull from. Obviously, you get picked over in California, but there's still a lot of talent out there in California and Arizona and even stretching to Hawaii. And so you've got to just get people in place that know how to sell their vision and what they're looking for. And sometimes that takes patient administration, who's not constantly looking to turn over every couple years, who understands it's going to take some time to get that footing. And I think that's a problem that you see across the country. And so, UNLV might be a little bit away from San Diego State, but I think that division is going to be a little bit more interesting this year because of the turnover that they've had at San Diego State.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what the coaching change brings. I think actually handing off to Hoke is why they'll probably be all right. Hoke not only was on the staff under Long, but he also used to coach San Diego State. He understands what success looks like. I mean, realistically, I've said this for years here and elsewhere, that I don't really get why San Diego isn't like an absolute behemoth. I mean, part of it is because they long shared a stadium in San Diego with the Chargers. They at least at the moment don't have an on-campus stadium. And I think that, that travel, as other teams that have to travel can attest to, like even UCLA, who has a storied history, like when you have to travel off campus and especially like in a crowded place like Southern California, like that can be prohibitive to fans, to students, to staff, faculty, anyone who wants to kind of be part of that. Like, I mean, we can both attest to like, having gone to Syracuse, you still being there, like there is something to be said for being able to walk, out of your dorm room through the quad and into the dome. And that's something that like, it's not the end all be all, but it is something that is very advantageous. And like for San Diego, like maybe it's not the only part of the cell, but I think if you're forced to play in a mostly tarped NFL stadium and at the time like a beaten down NFL stadium, I think that's going to hurt your sell. I think San Diego does have a really big alumni base. They have a lot of, I think most of their alums do stay in the Southern California area, which means that by and large, like fans are able to show up. The thing is, they don't have a lot of success to call on. I mean, really, Brady Hoke kind of ushered in this new era of prolonged success for the Aztecs. And I think while they're able to cash in on it here and there, you've seen some great running backs at San Diego State. I think we're still waiting for the real connection from a skill player standpoint. Like I wouldn't think that San Diego State would have trouble recruiting receivers and quarterbacks. And yet I do feel like they have one of the worst offenses in the country year in and year out while having one of the best defenses, and just hoping that it works out.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You should, you feel like every school in California and Texas should have quarterbacks and receivers, right? At the very least. And they may not be prototypical size or speed, but they should have people that come from high schools that are successful moving the ball and putting points on board. And you should just be able to transition that into to college. And, you know, even if you lose games 49 to 35, you're not having any trouble scoring no matter who you're playing. So that is interesting. And I totally agree with the stadium on campus. You know, I think when Syracuse was looking to move even just a couple miles down the hill, that was a terrible idea. Sure, when you're winning, people will go out of their way to go to games. But if you're just okay, every excuse for especially students not to show up is one thing you want to avoid. And so there's definitely some drawbacks to being off campus and being in something that you can't fill, and selling that obviously is something that we relate to as well. So I think that's the challenge. And you know, it also speaks to the difference in football in terms of basketball, in terms of, we talk about level playing field and the money. And so it's just going to be hard for any school that's in the, you know, G6 to make that next jump, no matter how successful they are on the field, unless they can really push into that alumni support to get some huge contributions to kind of narrow that gap.
Yeah, I mean, again, like San Diego has like notable alumni in football elsewhere. Like there's definitely like, really, I mean, I obviously, like, you know, it's about how much Marshall Faulk wants to get involved too. But I feel like if I had Marshall Faulk as an alum, I would probably be putting him to use a lot more just as a rule. Yeah. I mean, like, and you know, like you and I obviously have vivid memories of Marshall Faulk, either as a college player or a pro player. And a lot of these kids now don't necessarily realize just how great he was. I mean, just that highlight reel and the things he was able to do, you know, with football, I think that having him as an ambassador to bringing in, you know, elite skill talent, I think would really go a long way. And obviously San Diego's profile as an athletic program is far larger now than when it was when Faulk was there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you would think that it would be an easy sell for recruits to go there, especially when you think about other places that have been successful recruiting at that level.
Yeah. You could sell people on snow, or you could sell people on being near the beach. I mean, it's a nice campus and it definitely looks like a Southern California campus, I guess. Yeah, I've never understood why any school around here, at least, struggles. But, you know, these things happen, and there's a reason, I guess, why college football's history and present looks the way it does, is that it's not as simple as who is the best location. Otherwise, you'd probably see a very different list of, like, top-tier powers all the time.
Yes, it's building a real-life dynasty is a lot harder than building one on NCAA football.
All right, Kevin. So I guess closing out here, do you just see a chalk Boise State versus San Diego State championship game, or do you think that somebody else could maybe rise up here?
I think that would be what I would say right now. I would keep an eye on Wyoming, and for me, I would keep an eye on that Air Force Boise game in September, because that's going to be, I think, a big contest in that division. So right now I'd say Boise, San Diego State. That'd be my prediction.
Yeah, I think that's mine as well. Again, I just think that everybody in the West seems like they're like a year away from getting things together. Hawaii has some work to do, replacing a head coach. UNLV has a first year head coach and some things to do. I think Jay Norvell's done a good job at Nevada, but I don't think he's like elevated them. I think Brent Brennan still has more work to do at San Jose State. And I think Fresno made a good hire in Kalen DeBoer, but I mean, they've done it before where they've leapt up from the basement into conference contention. I just don't know if this is the year given what San Diego brings back on the defensive side.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's probably a lot of schools. I think next year, this conference could be really wide open and very entertaining to watch how it shakes out. But like you said, I think it's going to take a little bit of time for some of these schools to be at that level.
Agreed, agreed. And then who do you think wins between San Diego and Boise?
Boy, it's hard to go against Boise. I just think they're probably going to have enough of an offense. You know, I just think that I would give them the edge until you see San Diego State. I think at this point, yeah, I'll go with Boise, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Boise as well. I think Boise's still like a top 40-ish program. I think San Diego's probably more of a top 60-ish right now. And you know, we alluded to it earlier. Depends on what coaching does, you know, and if Hogue is as effective his second time around with SDSU as he was the first time. But I'm going to give Boise an edge, especially if they end up hosting the game.
Right. Yeah, that's Boise in December is always going to be an advantage playing a Southern California team.
Agreed, agreed. All right, Kevin, anything else before we head out today?
No, I think, you know, hopefully people keep suggesting ideas that they want to see from us as we still have a couple months left of off-season content, and make sure they're following the Get to Know Your Orange Men series. And so we can take a closer look at the Syracuse football 2020 roster.
Yeah, we're cranking along there. We're in the 50s now, but once we get through the whole thing, there'll also be like another run of new guys and number changes and things like that. So while it might seem like we're halfway through, we're not even close to halfway through.
Right.
All right. Well, Kevin, appreciate you hopping on late notice. I think it was, I think we still had a great episode.
Well, thanks for having me, and appreciate anytime. Always happy to come on and talk sports with you.
Of course, of course. That was Kevin. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noonan's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Megaphone, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, Overcast, wherever you may listen to podcasts, and go Orange.